I do think that most outside groups have a tin ear when it comes to Alaska.
Do ads from a group affiliated with the Koch brothers help or hurt their effort to unseat baggage? From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, March 19th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, making the case for cleaning up the hundreds of tons of tsunami debris on Alaska's shores.
This is our kitchen counter, and a rational person keeps our kitchen counters clean.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
In Alaska's U.S. Senate race, there's been so much talk about the billionaire Koch brothers, you might think they were running for office. They're not, though a Koch-affiliated group has already spent close to $1 million on ads against Mark Begich. The Cook Political Report today declared the race a toss-up, and Begich one of the Senate's most endangered Democrats. But as APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, the well-funded anti-Begich ad run may not be having the desired effect.
The Begich campaign aired its first TV ad this month. It doesn't talk up his achievements or criticize his challengers. It's all about the Kochs.
Who's behind the attacks?
The Koch brothers.
The billionaire Koch brothers.
The strategy of highlighting the Koch brothers is presumably working for Begich, says Anchorage political blogger Amanda Coyne, because he does the same in virtually all his fundraising appeals.
It's really hard to get an email from Begich without mentioning the Kochs.
Now, point of clarification, people talk about the Koch brothers' ads against Begich. The ads are sponsored by Americans for Prosperity, a group the Koch brothers helped found. Whether they're still funding it isn't disclosed. AFP says it has some 90,000 donors. The Kochs, though, make an attractive target. Charles and David Koch are two of the wealthiest men in America, tied for fourth place, according to Forbes magazine. And they give big to conservative and libertarian causes. Nationally, the Democrats are taking aim directly at the Kochs, and it's personal. Here's the top Democrat in the Senate, Harry Reid.
What is going on with these two brothers who made billions of dollars last year, an attempt to buy our democracy, is dishonest, deceptive, false.
Some columnists and bloggers have said they're the best enemy the Democrats could imagine. A gift, really, because railing against the Kochs fires up the left and drives donations. Begich says he's not so sure about that.
You know, I don't know if it helps me or not, but I just know one thing. We're going to tell Alaskans about these groups like his, like the Koch brothers, and tell them that we're up against billionaires and we need their help.
Campaigning against the Kochs is a page straight out of the latest National Democratic playbook, and it might be an especially easy play in Alaska. To start with, as the Begich ad points out, Koch Industries is closing a refinery near Fairbanks, a refinery with a water pollution problem. But it's more than that. Anchorage political consultant and ad pro Art Hackney calls the Kochs lovely men. He says they should receive more praise for things like their huge donations to hospitals. But Hackney says the Kochs, meaning Americans for Prosperity, have probably helped Begich more than they've hurt him.
Senator Begich didn't listen. How can I ever trust him again?
That, says Hackney, is Exhibit A, the ad featuring a fake Alaskan in her kitchen complaining about Begich.
Well, I mean, all of us make mistakes, but the minute it was outed so rapidly that that was a Maryland actress, the ad should have been pulled down.
Instead, the ad ran and ran, Hackney says, in effect helping Begich show how outsiders are attacking him. It also allowed a pro-Begich super PAC to air an ad ridiculing it that Hackney calls quite effective. Americans for Prosperity tends to run the same ad in several states, just changing the name of the Democratic target. Hackney says that doesn't work well on Alaskans, in part because they often know their U.S. senators face-to-face.
I do think that most outside groups have a tenure when it comes to Alaska, because they're used to, in other states, being able to be a lot more generic in their messages. And Alaskans, you know, need to be talked to in different ways.
Hackney's not a disinterested party here. He formed a super PAC supporting Dan Sullivan, one of Begich's Republican challengers, which pays him for professional services. Hackney would like to work as an advisor to out-of-state groups like Americans for Prosperity that plan to run ads against Begich. For one thing, he'd advise AFP to quit running ads saying Begich supports a carbon tax. Begich calls it a lie, and Hackney says most Alaskans don't know enough about the term to care.
It's a whole lot of money spent not to have a great deal of effect.
AFP didn't make anyone available for an interview. Mark Helenthal, an Anchorage pollster and political marketing guy, also picked carbon tax as a losing issue for an anti-Begich ad. He says AFP's decision to run it shows they don't get the state.
There's a certain lack of understanding of what issues play in Alaska and what issues don't, and their ads haven't reflected an appreciation for that.
He describes it as more than a waste of money. Helenthal, who has no clients in the Senate race, says the attack ads are giving Begich something meaty to run against.
I think, yeah, Begich's counter-negative is what we call it, is very effective.
Helenthal, though, says he'd have to see some polling data to believe Americans for Prosperity and the Koch brothers are doing their cause more harm than good. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
After 6 hours of debate, the state Senate voted in favor of a bill advancing a natural gas mega project where Alaska is a part owner. While the legislation passed with a clear majority, APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports there was opposition from Democrats who had problems with the deal brokered by the Parnell administration.
Historic, momentous. Those were the words legislators used in the lead-up to the vote.
By a vote of 15 yeas and 5 nays, Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 138, Finance Amended, has passed the Senate.
The yeas came mostly from Republicans and rural Democrats. 4 Anchorage Democrats and Sitka Senator Bert Stedman, a key Republican critic of the Parnell administration's energy policy, voted against it out of concern that the state is not getting enough out of the arrangement. The bill authorizes the state to partner with the North Slope producers, the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, and TransCanada in construction of a natural gas pipeline that would cost at least $45 billion. The gas transported on the pipeline would be sold on the global market, and a portion would be reserved for Alaska consumers along the pipeline corridor. Some of the revenue from the gas would also be set aside to offset rural energy costs. Senator John Coghill, a Republican from North Pole, said that while the legislation is complex, he sees it as a way of accomplishing a popular goal in the state.
It really comes down to some really simple basics, right? We have gas, we want to sell it, and we want to get the benefit of it here in Alaska, whether it's in molecules or in cash.
But while the goal may be popular, some senators have issues with how the Parnell administration is going about it. A group of Anchorage Democrats offered 16 amendments to the bill. While none of those amendments were adopted, the minority used them to highlight what they saw as weak spots. A number of changes had to do with TransCanada's involvement in the project, an arrangement that has irritated some members of both parties during committee hearings. The state has been in contract with TransCanada and making payouts to the company since the Palin administration, when the last effort to develop a high-volume pipeline happened. Under the new plan, TransCanada would help the state finance the project and get a portion of the state's share in the pipeline in exchange. Minority Leader Hollis French said the state was giving them too much in this arrangement. He suggested it might even be time to break off the relationship and put the work out to bid.
It's just not working out. You know, it's just not working out. It's time for us to go back to the drawing board, I think, to separate and to let this process go forward without them taking 60% of my share of this pipeline.
Senator Kathy Geisel of Anchorage was one of the Republicans who opposed that idea. She said trying to find a new partner could slow down the project and add new costs to it.
$800 million a year, adding up. We don't know who else would bid. Under AGEA, there was one bidder, one complete bidding package, and that was TransCanada. Why would we expect different today?
Democrats also wanted a guarantee that municipalities along the pipeline route would not lose the ability to negotiate property taxes on land used. And they argued for upping the state's equity in the project from 25% to 51%. In the end, none of their amendments attracted more than a couple of Republican defectors. During the closing speeches, Soldotna Republican Peter Michicki stressed that all projects like this come with a risk. The highest projected costs for the state are upward of $10 billion, and the highest levels of return are forecasted at $4 billion a year. In this case, Michicki thinks the risk is worth it.
Will it come to a final investment decision? I don't know. We still have the AGDC project as a backup. I don't have a crystal ball, neither does anyone in this room. I think what's missing from the opposition here are ideas to move us forward, and I think I have a difficult time with that.
The bill now goes to the House. They have 1 month to review it before the legislature gavels out. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, getting the word out about how Alaska Natives are affected by the Affordable Care Act.
We've been from Barrow to Ketchikan, from Bethel to Fairbanks, Illiamna, Dillingham, Kotzebue, Nome.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
It's time for the Healthy Futures Challenge. Pull out the jump ropes or go sledding with the family and get out and play. Get moving with activities the whole family enjoys. Find out if your child's elementary school is participating in the Healthy Futures Challenge. Healthy kids are happy kids. Inspire your kids to get out and play every day. For more ways to get active, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The state is planning an aerial survey this spring to figure out how much new debris from the 2011 Japanese tsunami has arrived on Alaska's shores. Environmental groups spent much of last summer cleaning up debris, but the state's vast and rugged coastline has made it a slow and costly project. APRN's Annie Fite returned to Montague Island on the edge of Prince William Sound with the man who's leading the effort to help Alaska's hardest-hit beaches get back to their pristine state.
Chris Pallister steps out of the helicopter onto the snow-covered inner shore of Montague Island.
We couldn't land in here in the summertime. There's a bunch of huge logs and stuff in here.
Pallister is president of Gulf of Alaska Keeper. It's a brilliantly sunny day in early March, and Pallister's visiting Montague to get a handle on how much new debris washed up on the island over the winter. He also needs to check on debris his crew collected into heavy-duty bags called super sacks last summer. Pallister wants to make sure they held up over the punishing winter months.
I guess it's all right. I don't see any real damage here or anything.
He rummages through a bag perched on the edge of a huge mound of super sacks. The bag is open on top, but otherwise looks okay.
Tie it up so it doesn't blow away anymore.
And so describe what's in there, what's in the bag.
So anywhere from tiny little pieces of styrofoam all the way up to buoys and ropes and nets, but a tremendous amount of urethane foam and polystyrene foam and just plain styrofoam.
Pallister measures debris not by the pound, but by the ton. And on outer Montague Island, he estimates there's 20 to 30 tons of debris per mile. He guesses about half of it is from the tsunami, and half is the usual marine trash that's been washing up in increasing amounts for decades. Last summer, he used funding from the legislature and other sources to begin cleaning up the first 3 miles of the island's coast.
There's another almost 70 miles to do on this shoreline. And we spent probably close to 60 days cleaning these few miles that we did here. So this is a huge, huge problem. This island is really bad.
The state identified Montague as one of 9 priority areas for tsunami debris cleanup. There are other hot spots from the southern tip of southeast and as far west as the islands off of Kodiak. Japan gave the United States $5 million for cleaning up debris in all the West Coast states. So far, Alaska has received the biggest chunk of that money, $1 million. Elaine Bussey Floyd is a director at the Department of Environmental Conservation. She thinks the state will be able to make the case for more funding than other coastal states receive.
They really didn't get the quantities of debris that we did. Oregon has somewhere around 300 miles of coastline, and, you know, we would call that a day trip, okay? And they were able to put dumpsters and have volunteers go out, and they just had to empty a few dumpsters a little more often, and that's completely not the situation that Alaska is faced with.
Alaska's situation is vast coastline, often inaccessible even to small landing craft, combined with huge quantities of debris. Floyd is working on a federal grant application for more funding that would pay for a barge to pick up the super sacks Palliser and other groups are collecting. A helicopter would lift the sacks onto the barge, and then the trash would go to a recycling center in Seattle or landfill in Oregon. Palliser is hopeful that funding will come through. He says it will cost millions more just to clean Montague.
There's actually a lot of new stuff here.
He points out debris as he walks along the shale rock shore next to the surf.
That's an Asian bottle. Japanese. Look at all this plastic. This stuff was all just cleaned, in September.
Montague Island is a spectacular stretch of Alaska shoreline. Palliser says the island has some of the richest habitat in Prince William Sound. It's home to sea lions, brown bears, and has a strong silver salmon run. It's popular with local hunters, but few other people visit. Palliser is determined to clean it anyway.
People always ask me, why do you do this? Why would you keep doing this if it keeps coming back? And I just tell them that, you know, you clean your kitchen counters. This is where we get our sustenance in this state. The intertidal area is where a lot of our fishing resources and all that came from. So I say, this is our kitchen counter. And a rational person keeps their kitchen counters clean.
On his way back to the helicopter, Palliser compulsively picks up bottles and other small items and flings them above the tide line. He and his crew will be back to put them in super sacks later this summer. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
To see a video of Palliser's trip to Montague Island, go to our website, alaskapublic.org. For most Americans, the deadline to sign up for health insurance under the Affordable Care Act is March 31st. For American Indians and Alaska Natives, the process is a little different. The Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium and United Way have teamed up at Juneau's gold medal basketball tournament to get the word out. KTOO's Lisa Fu reports.
Jamie Paddock traveled from Hoonah to cheer on her hometown team. Attending gold medal is an annual tradition. In between games, she visits a healthcare information table.
My grandfather told me I might win a gift card if I sign up here, so.
Paddock isn't actually signing up for anything. She's filling out an Indian status exemption form. Monique Martin is with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium.
It's a little bit of a complicated form, even though it's pretty short. It's only about 3 pages, but there's some tricky questions. And it just means that if you don't have health insurance, you could face a tax penalty. And if you send in that exemption, that gives you a lifetime exemption from the requirements of the Affordable Care Act.
Paddock's healthcare provider is Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, which doesn't require insurance, but she does have Blue Cross as well as Medicaid.
We have a very robust tribal health system in the state of Alaska. So the exemption is really to acknowledge that Alaska Natives and American Indians have access to tribal health and Indian health services to get their healthcare needs met.
Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium is targeting almost 50,000 Alaska Natives without insurance. They're the ones who could face a tax penalty.
The exemption form does not eliminate your ability to get insurance either at healthcare.gov or through an employer. It just covers you in the case that you have a gap in your insurance coverage.
So far, Martin says the Tribal Health Consortium has helped fill out more than 2,200 Indian status exemption forms. One form can cover an individual or family.
We've also sent out thousands of emails, or also we print them up and mail them to people in rural parts of our state.
Only a paper version of the exemption form is available this year. You print it, fill it in, and mail it, or have it all done at Gold Medal.
Don't forget to include a copy of either a tribal enrollment card or some proof that you're an ANCSA shareholder or a copy of your Certificate of Indian Blood card issued by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. If you don't, the feds will send you back a letter saying your application is not complete.
A healthcare information table will be at Gold Medal through Saturday.
We've been from Barrow to Ketchikan, from Bethel to Fairbanks, Iliamna, Dillingham, Kotzebue, Nome. We've been to lots and lots of places to spread the word.
Open enrollment for Alaska Natives interested in getting health insurance is ongoing. There is no deadline. And Alaska Natives have until the end of the year to submit an Indian status exemption form. Although, if you do it at Gold Medal, you could win a gift card. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering dental innovations from implants and Invisalign with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the trail. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
It's herring time in Southeast Alaska. As KCAW's Rachel Waldholz reports, the multi-million dollar Sitka Sound sackrow herring fishery could open as early as the end of this week.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game has announced that as of 8 a.m. on March 20th, the Sitka Sound sackrow herring fishery will be on two-hour notice. That means seiners could have their nets in the water as soon as Thursday if the department's test samples find a high enough percentage of mature roe, or eggs, in the fish by then. The Sitka herring fishery packs major economic impact into a short time span. The roe is sold to markets in Asia, and on average, the fishery, which only lasts about a week, is worth a total of nearly $6 million to fishermen at the docks. Seiners will target over 16,000 tons of herring in Sitka Sound this year. That's considerably more than last year's limit, but it's a target, not a guarantee. For the last 2 years, the herring spawn has happened so quickly that the fleet wasn't able to catch the full limit. To harvest the roe, the herring must be caught before they spawn, in the window of time between when the female fish develop mature eggs and when they actually move to shore to lay those eggs. Determining that window is the difficult job of fish and game biologist Dave Gordon. He said the department decided to put the fishery on notice this week so that they'll be ready in case things start to move fast.
And we have very large fish, and the sample that we saw yesterday was really as big as they get in Sitka Sound, 200 gram plus fish, and from what we've seen from those larger fish is when they get ready to spawn, they go, and they do it in a hurry, so we want to be prepared for that.
Once it opens, the fishery will progress in stages. There's only enough processing capacity in Sitka to handle about 4,000 to 5,000 tons of herring at once. With 48 seiners participating in the fishery, that typically means the opening only lasts a few hours, Gordon said.
You're really putting them on the fish. You know, the fish are there, and you've got 48 boats that have, you know, very huge capacity to catch fish, and it doesn't take long to get the kind of tonnage that we'd be looking for. You know, 4,000 or 5,000 tons can be caught in 15 minutes, depending on the situation.
After an opening, the fishery must then close for about 2 days to allow the processors to work through the catch. With a harvest level of about 16,000 tons, Gordon said, he's anticipating about 4 separate openings. But right now, he can't say for sure. As with everything else, it depends on the herring. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Rachel Waldholz.
A bill that would place a priority on personal use dip net fishing has been working its way through the system since it was introduced in the state legislature last year. The bill had a hearing in the House Fisheries Committee yesterday. KBBI's Aaron Selbig reports.
The language of the bill is fairly simple. It calls on the State Board of Fisheries to, quote, place restrictions on all other fisheries before restricting personal use fisheries.
I think I'm on the right side representing Alaskans. I think the momentum and the support is on my side of the issue, and I think it's on Alaska's side of the issue, and I'm not going away.
That's Representative Bill Stoltz, the Wasilla Republican who introduced the bill last year. So far, the bill hasn't made it out of House Fisheries, where it received a hearing Tuesday. Stoltz told the committee that his bill has broad support, not only among his constituents, but with all of the estimated 33,000 Alaskan households that go dip netting every summer. Representative Lynn Gaddis, also from Wasilla, is on the Fisheries Committee. She agreed with Stoltz and promised she would sign onto the bill as a co-sponsor with him. She said dip netting is an Alaskan tradition.
These aren't people with fancy gear or anything like that. I mean, these are people with kids with life jackets on, with mud up to their knees, with, you know, coolers that I see a husband and wife packing up the hill to try to, ultimately, they're filling their freezers. And ultimately, I think that's the discussion that I think that we're having today is we've got to help people have that opportunity.
Charles Swanton is director of the Sport Fish Division at the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. He said his department is, quote, neutral on the bill. He says that as things stand right now, sockeye salmon are supposed to be regulated with commercial fisheries in mind. He said any change to that would have to be considered first by the Board of Fish. Committee member Eric Feige, a Republican from Chickaloon, wondered aloud whether Stoltz trusted the Board of Fish.
You're basically dictating to the Board of Fish, you know, a priority of, you know, putting personal use fisheries at a level higher than others. What's the compelling reason for taking that responsibility for that decision away from them?
One, the system's broken, and two, I listen to my constituents. That's probably the largest reason. I listen to my constituents who have serious problems with this issue. They see that it's not working right now.
Stoltz said he thinks the Board of Fish is stacked in favor of Cook Inlet commercial drift fishermen. Because of a scheduled House floor session, Tuesday's hearing was cut short. Committee Chairman and Homer Representative Paul Seaton promised that Alaskans who had signed up to testify about the bill would have another opportunity to speak at a later date. Reporting from Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Lisa Fu in Juneau, Rachel Waldholtz in Sitka, and Aaron Selbig in Homer. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
And by
Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2014 PFD. Paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov or on Facebook. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
The BLM has released a draft supplemental environmental impact statement, which analyzes impacts from the Greater Moose's Tooth 1 project of the NPRA, including construction and operation of a drill site, access road, and pipelines. A 60-day public comment period closes on April 22nd. BLM will hold public meetings and take comments in Fairbanks on March 19th and Anchorage on March 20th. Go to BLM's website at blm.gov/ak for more information. This message is sponsored by the Bureau of Land Management.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.